WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and the World Bank are scheduled to meet November 16th through 19th in Ottawa, Ontario. Their meeting was originally scheduled for last month in Washington, D.C., but was canceled as a result of the September 11th attacks. Hundreds of thousands of protesters were expected to challenge the actions of the IMF and World Bank in the streets of Washington. Tonight, we're going to explore in depth how the IMF works, what it actually does, who benefits from its policies, and why many people call its activities economic terrorism. In our first hour, we'll hear a variety of perspectives on the IMF and World Bank, including revelations from a former leading official who had a change of heart and turned whistleblower. In the second hour, a new edition of Wizards of Money. The subject of tonight's edition of Wizards is Monetary Terrorism, how the IMF and Wall Street speculators profit by destroying the economies of countries throughout the developing world by attacking their currencies. Our first guest tonight is Soren Ambrose of the 50 Years is Enough Network, a non-governmental organization that focuses on the IMF and World Bank's impact on the people of the Global South. Ambrose was in Ithaca late last month. He spoke with Raj Patel about why people the world over have been fighting the IMF and corporate globalization.
My name is Raj Patel, and my guest today is Soren Ambrose of the 50 Years is Enough Network. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what the 50 Years is Enough does.
Well, 50 Years is Enough was founded as a campaign back in 1994, which was the 50th anniversary of the creation of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And since that time, it has been working to publicize the flaws in the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, hence the name 50 Years is Enough. We do that by talking with the media, by doing popular education, by doing advocacy in the United States Congress, and by trying to build stronger and stronger coalitions internationally to draw attention to what the World Bank and the IMF do and come up with ways to prevent them from continuing to have the power to impose the policies that they seem to favor.
In that list of things, I noticed you didn't mention street protesting. Is 50 Years Enough involved in the sorts of street protests that we've seen?
Good point. Yeah, we are involved in the protests. Oftentimes, as with the protests that ultimately did not go ahead at the end of September, our main role is to make sure that there are people from the southern countries, the countries that are affected by the World Bank and IMF, at the protests and at the educational events. And that was sufficient to organize protests of 100 people, which is where we were at before Seattle. Now that we have protests of thousands or even tens of thousands, we're hardly able to cope with all of that organizing. So we're one of many who are responsible for the street protests.
Okay. And I wonder if you could tell us, even if your role in the street protests is a little diminished, what anti-globalization protesting is?
It's a phenomenon that has been going on in one form or another for many, many years. It's just that the protests, when they took place in the countries of the South, in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean, these were domestic protests. They were protesting the policies that their government had adopted at the behest of the IMF or the World Bank. So it so happens that the policies were the policies of corporate globalization, but they were not viewed as part of a movement until people in the North, in Europe and North America and Australia, which is not exactly the North, but is part of that group, started to join in and point out that what was happening in Venezuela was also happening in Zimbabwe, was also happening in Thailand, putting together an analysis that said that this is a unified phenomenon of people in the North people who use the governments who use the IMF and the World Bank, which they control through their economic domination, to impose policies that benefit corporations and wealthy investors in those very wealthy countries. So the protests that emerged once this analysis became more widespread throughout the populations of the northern countries were of people who were interested because of the impact that these policies had on the environment, that they had on labor rights, that they had on poverty, entrenching poverty instead of diminishing it. So there were different angles to come at this from, but the common thread was that everyone was beginning to recognize that the policies of international financial institutions were what brought together these various interests. They had a common enemy, as it were, even if their primary interest was one or the other sector. It was all being done in the same method, and we had to go after the World Bank and the IMF, and therefore it was very natural to come together as coalitions and ultimately come together in street protests when these institutions meet in cities around the north, as they usually do.
Well, I don't know. I wonder if I can play devil's advocate, because in a lot of, I mean, in the apologists for globalization sort of Bible, the Lexus and the Olive Tree, Thomas Friedman, a man of many anecdotes and little wisdom, but you know, the man can spin a good tale. He tells us lots of stories about how people in the South have been uplifted by corporations, how, in fact, the globalization that, you know, that you're opposing and that, you know, possibly the misguided kids in the street are opposing is, in fact, the very globalization that is going to bring jobs, is going to bring healthcare, is going to bring education, and a better standard of life. And, in fact, not only that, but then Thomas Friedman feels, and people at the World Bank and people at the IMF and, you know, The Economist and all these sorts of fine establishment institutions with a questionable command of language and an even more questionable command of logic, will then sort of point to these places and say, well, you know, but look at the figures. You know, since the 1900s, things have unquestionably been getting better, and there's been more globalization at the same time. There's been more corporations, not less, more trade, not less, more financial flows, not fewer. So, I mean, what do you say to that sort of overwhelming evidence?
Actually, I think the first thing to say, if I can start at the end of your comments, is that trying to measure globalization is a tricky thing. It's true that it looks like world trade is increasing and so on, but in fact, a lot of the trade that's being measured now is within corporations, moving across borders to different between different branches of corporations, but is not really goods changing hands and jobs being created. In addition, it's also possible to say that globalization was a much bigger phenomenon in the 19th century during the era of the colonial empires of Britain, France, the Netherlands, Portugal, and so on, because at that time we had entire economies in Europe supported by a system that was devoted entirely to providing cheap goods and cheap labor to European markets. But if you look at the statistics, the way it plays out, it may not look like the same kind of globalization we have now, since it was moving within one governmental jurisdiction, the British Empire, for example. It's also the case that the era between 1871 or so and 1914 was, by some gauges, the most heavily globalized era of all. And it's only recently that we've begun to come close to the amount of cross-border trading that was going on, particularly in the years leading right up to World War I. So really what is often thought of as the golden age of capitalism, at least from the American standpoint, or Pax Americana, the era right after World War II, was a time when there were actually fairly substantial capacity to direct one's government's own trading policies. And in fact, I think it's probably instructive to note that the Bretton Woods Conference, where the World Bank and the IMF were founded, had on its agenda the formation of a third institution in addition to IMF and World Bank, called the International Trade Organization, which they ended up not forming precisely because the United States had a lot of banks and corporations which were resistant to the idea that there might be an international body that could impose liberalization measures that were unwanted by United States interests. The World Trade Organization, which serves somewhat the same function as the ITO was supposed to serve, only came about after the World Bank and IMF had succeeded through their structural adjustment programs in setting up legal structures in most of the countries of the Global South, such that corporations from the Global North had huge advantages, and the WTO ended up being a way of entrenching and guaranteeing and having a court of last appeal for corporations to exercise their advantage. And indeed, the rules that have been set up at the WTO have been set up differently than would have been done in 1944. And we see, instead of an attempt to preserve sovereign rights of governments, an attempt to preserve the profits of corporations.
From what I know of the ITO, there also would have been labor and non-state representation within the International Trade Organization as well as governments.
Yes, that would have been different, wouldn't it?
Yep. But okay, but there's still, you know, there's still the question of, well, all right, say you take the question of poverty in developing countries seriously. How does chanting up and down, you know, sort of up and down the streets of Washington do anyone any good?
Yes, and I realize now I totally left Thomas Friedman out of my previous response, and I would like to hurt him first. It is the case that Mr. Friedman and, in fact, the general line among advocates of World Bank IMF-style policies do say that the protests that go on are, in fact, how does Friedman put it? They're not the pro-economic justice crowd. They're the keep everyone else poor and us rich crowd or something like that, with the idea being that it was all an elaborate protectionist scheme, these protests, a way of preserving high-paying jobs in the United States at the expense of trade that would enrich other countries. I think that if one looks at the way that the World Bank and the IMF operate, they will, and the WTO for that matter, they'll see a different story. Oftentimes, we're told that the United States and other industrial economies developed precisely by offering cheap labor, growing products that they could sell on world markets, and therefore other countries should develop in the same way. The problem with that equation, the problem with the idea that Thomas Friedman would put forward, that it's just a matter of low-wage jobs for the present that will lay the foundation for a more prosperous future, is that in the United States, in the United Kingdom, in other European countries, workers were able to create a counterweight to corporate power by organizing. And they were able to organize and gain leverage in negotiations with their employers because the employers were serving a local market. There was not an option in the 19th century for someone who wanted to sell shirts in New York City to produce those shirts in Nicaragua. The transportation costs were prohibitive, obviously, as well as other infrastructure problems. What we have now is a case where the facilities have been put in place. You can build the kind of assembly plant you need to produce those shirts in Central America or even in Asia. And you can fly or ship those goods from that place to the market in the north. And you can do all of that travel and all of that remote management of a foreign labor force more cheaply than you can employ people at the point of sale or closer to the point of sale. And so if that's the case, it's also quite logically the case that as soon as there's a difference in what you're paying the workers in the country where you have your plant and another country, the other country being cheaper, that you have every incentive in the world to simply build another factory there and continue to hopscotch around the Caribbean, Latin America, Asia, so that as soon as workers begin to organize, the corporations will threaten to move. And in most cases, we've seen that disorganization is thwarted, often with government connivance in these countries where these assembly plants, or as they're sometimes called, sweatshops, are located. So there's no way, really, for workers to build up the kind of leverage, the kind of power that they would need to follow the pattern that happened in in the industrialized economies, where they can indeed be sure that they are building towards some better future, if not for themselves, then for the next generation. Similarly, for the idea of selling agricultural products, commodities, for example, as a way of working to your competitive advantage and in that way building up capacity. The problem here, of course, is very simply the law of supply and demand, which is perhaps the most elementary economic law. But the World Bank and IMF have recommended to all of their clients practically that they produce those goods they can produce most easily, sell them on the world market, and earn hard currency that way. But this means that they are all producing the same goods, coffee, cocoa, tea, cut flowers, tobacco, and they're not producing food for their people because they don't have an infinite amount of land. So you have the problem of feeding their people, plus you have the problem that the cost or the price of these goods on international markets will stay low because the supply is so high. So countries that were promised that they could sell things on the international markets, make enough money to pay back their debts, and buy the food that they were no longer growing, have found that they can't pay back their debts the way they thought, and they can't afford the food on international markets. So it's been a disaster all the way around, and no one's building any capacity. And in fact, countries are seeking out food aid in far too many cases. So the idea that you can follow old models in the new kind of globalized economy we have now is pretty easily demolished, I think.
That makes sense. But what doesn't make sense then? I mean, what one of the things that the economic justice movement is about is that the processes of neoliberalism are everywhere. One of the interesting and exciting things about Seattle and about the global justice movement since Seattle, since December 1999, has been the way that this sort of anti-corporate resistance has started to build in the U.S. And I know that one of the things that 50 Years Is Enough does is articulate that resistance from around the world to Congress. This is the question that troubles me as a non-American here now after September 11th. It seems to me to be the case that supporting corporations is the patriotic thing to do. And this strikes me as bonkers in so many ways. It's corporations, after all, that are laying off workers hand over fist and then getting subsidized by the government for it. And the workers who are saying, and this is, and I'm proud to be an American. I may not have a job. I may not, I may be receiving pitifully little in terms of severance or unemployment benefit. Vast amounts of federal money may be going to support a war against people, about whom I know nothing. And nonetheless, there's a great deal of flag waving by the erstwhile supporters of the anti-globalization movement, the unions. I wonder if you could speak to that a little bit, because I just don't understand what's going on. How did it happen that these entities, Benjamin Franklin, for example, was very suspicious of the corporation, has now all of a sudden become the thing to rally behind in these times?
That's a rather provocative question, Raj. I think that if you were to ask a union member who was waving a flag, proverbially speaking, why they were supporting corporations with their support of U.S. policy, why they were supporting a system that ultimately was not acting in their interest nor in the interest of world peace or any of those other lovely nostrums, I think that you would find that the kind of national cultural mythology that we have in this country is that at a time of crisis, which this has been defined as, the patriotic or the right thing to do is to be patriotic. And being patriotic means supporting the establishment. And the establishment is corporations. And you're right, it's very strange, particularly given the competing national mythologies of the kind of cowboy culture we have here, where the United States and its citizens are, willing to take a stand alone if they must, and not fall into received wisdom of the countries of kings and queens and other primitive customs like that. But in fact, I think that there's a very powerful sense of the need to conform at a perceived time of crisis, and I'm not sure I actually completely understand, perhaps because I'm still too far inside the culture, how we've managed to build up this system of taboos, why critical thinking seems, which is not in abundant supply in the United States to begin with, but why it seems to become so much scarcer once a crisis like this develops. And actually, let me add, though, that there hasn't been a crisis quite like this. Say, the taking of the hostages in Iran in 1979, that's a more, you know, why there was jingoism then as well. I think you could call that pathological. In this case, there's a pathology at work, but it's also, it's such a unique circumstance that I think we're dealing with a case of cultural shell shock as well. And I think that it's not unique to the United States. I think it's probably more intense here, but people really don't know what the hell to do because there's never been anything like September 11th. And yet, I mean, it's possible to say, you know, societies have suffered much longer, much worse. Of course, that's true. But September 11th still has a unique status, at least to the way I'm perceiving it. And so when people don't know what to do or think or react to, I think probably they swing back to comfortable old rhythms. And, you know, for us, the comfortable old rhythm is President Eisenhower in 1953 or 1954 when everything was in black and white and everyone waved the flag and everyone had a father, a mother, and two sisters and a dog. And that ideal, for whatever reason, kicks back in when we're deprived of our bearings.
I mean, then would it be, I suppose it would be insensitive of me to suggest that maybe the anti-corporate globalization movement has a chance to reclaim the idea of patriotism. Not that I approve of patriotism, but if it's going to be around in any form, then it might as well be of that sort of cowboy type, of the type that is iconoclastic, that's about freedom of expression, that's about the freedoms that free the oppressed. But I don't know quite how that might be articulated. But it certainly seems to be an opportunity that didn't exist before, to rally behind these ideas that. Yeah, there do seem to be some things that are palpably good about the American dream. I know I'm not a friend of the United States government, but certainly some of the visions on which this country is founded seem to be, you know, noble ones, despite the genocide that was required to form this country.
Can we try to turn this on its head and reclaim a kind of fidelity to traditional American ideals by standing up for the notion that it's not in U.S. interest, nor is it the right thing to do to kill more people to avenge some of our people being killed? I've certainly seen and heard that advocated, but I think that in a case like this, with a unique marshaling of all of the forces of the establishment to enforce the conformity on this particular score, that that's probably a waste of time. Although it bears saying, but I think trying to actually make it, you know, a common thing for people to think is probably a futile hope. In terms of where the movement is actually going, I think that internationally, the movement is going in much the same place it was before. I know that in Asia and Africa and probably in Latin America, which I know a little bit less about, what happened in Washington was horrible thing, but it was not necessarily the thing that will change their lives forever. And in fact, it was one more disaster in a world that has endured many disasters. And in fact, the IMF and the World Bank and the WTO and the corporations and the corrupt governments and everyone else are still practicing the same games in those countries. So I think that the protests in the Global South will continue in along very much the same lines. I know there is fear of increased repression, particularly if particular governments are drawn more closely within the U.S. orbit, and increased charges of terrorism against civil society organizations, which would be unfortunately not terribly surprising. But in Europe, I think it's between the two. There is a lot of uncertainty there, a lot of taboos about talking about this incident and the fallout still, not as much as in North America, perhaps. But I think that for the North, we will probably go through a period where the confrontational style of protest, while it will probably continue, will probably not be as well attended as it has been. And there will probably be more passionate cries for stricter nonviolence guidelines at protests, more of a trend towards making sure that any provocative actions at protests are kept in an isolated location. And I think that in terms of our effectiveness, we'll probably find that we will be able to, I don't know exactly what they are yet, but we will be able to find new ways of appealing to the media and to the public, given the new attention, whatever form it may take, to international affairs. I mean, the United States is particularly ignorant of the rest of the world. And in a sense, just as, you know, you might say that there's no such thing as bad publicity if you're trying to get publicity, there may be no such thing as bad news in the sense that people are starting to look at a map of the world. Therefore, a certain subset of people in general might be more receptive to hearing about what is actually happening in a whole range of other places in the world, and we should act to jump on that attention as effectively and quickly as we can.
And so, I mean, in terms of next steps that people, you know, concretely might be able to take, are there, you know, upcoming events that you'd like to tell us about, or sort of things that people can do, particularly, as I say, in these times?
Yeah, certainly the immediate need in the United States, and depending on when this is broadcast and what happens in Congress, it may already be over, but the fast-track battle is going on in the U.S. Congress, and there's few places where it's more essential to try to stop any momentum from building behind the idea that free trade is the way to combat terrorism, because that's how fast-track is being sold. Fast-track, the device whereby the president can negotiate trade treaties, particularly in this case the Free Trade Area of the Americas, without Congress insisting on amendments but having to approve or disapprove without debate. That's the most immediate need for people to contact their members of Congress to tell them to oppose fast track. In the more medium term, we have, well, almost immediately actually, the World Trade Organization is slated to meet in Qatar November 9th, and there are events around the world in opposition to that. There is, in my estimation, still a good chance that that meeting will be postponed. But whether or not it is, there will be events focusing on the WTO and the entire philosophy of free trade. And after that, November 17th and 18th in Ottawa, there will be two different meetings going on. One is called the G20, or Group of 20 Countries, which is a combination of the wealthy G7 countries and some of the largest developing country economies on the 17th. And the World Bank and the IMF holding the meetings, the essential meetings that were postponed at the end of September in Washington. And that will be attended by protests on Saturday the 17th, being organized by folks from Quebec and Ontario, as well as by educational events, seminars, and media events also, where we'll be talking about the World Bank's very clumsy attempts in recent weeks to try to defend their policies against what some of their critics have been saying. So that takes us through November. After that, a lot of it will depend on where the military actions of the United States and its allies have gone. Nonetheless, I think that as we go forward into 2002, we will be seeing people around the world talking to each other with even more frequency. In fact, already the very fact of September 11th has spurred a number of international meetings just to touch base and connect with people. And these, although I'm not convinced that we're going to come out with a unified response from international civil society to September 11th, the very fact of all of these meetings is actually generating other ideas divorced from that. So I'm looking forward to the synergy that's being created by all of this increased conversation we're having, exhausting as it may seem at times.
So yes, in the words of Joe Hill, don't mourn, organize. Well, without wanting to exhaust you more, thank you very much indeed, Soren Ambrose, for coming to Unwelcome Guests. My name is Raj Patel.
Thank you.
What does the IMF have to say for itself? Community radio station CKUT in Montreal's Monday Morning After News program spoke with Tom Dawson, publicity director for the IMF, and with Michelle Chisadovsky, a professor of economics at the University of Ottawa, who has written extensively on the negative impacts of IMF policies. CKUT had originally asked Dawson to debate Chisadovsky, but Dawson declined.
We can talk a bit about the structural adjustment policy of the International Monetary Fund. About what kind of policies on a broad level does the IMF encourage countries to follow? And since when do you have this structural adjustment policy? And what are the uses of it?
Well, structural adjustment is a word that can mean many things to many people. Critics of the fund and the World Bank would lead you to believe that it's absolutely wrong in all occasions. What structural adjustment really is about balancing budgets, about having finances where the books are met, where countries are not running into tremendous debt, deficit, inflation problems. So so-called structural adjustment often does involve is, for example, if there's a steel mill in a country that is uneconomical, losing lots of money, the reality is the government, and this government-owned, the reality is the government probably shouldn't be in that business. And indeed, the steel mill may not be necessary, and indeed it's likely to be a heavily polluting activity. You know, we're also accused under the name of the rubric of structural adjustment of slashing social spending or spending on health, education, and so on. We think that charge is absolute nonsense, and we, you know, believe and have documents to prove and argue that indeed when countries come to the IMF, the end result is that they spend more money on assistance to the poor in education and health than in countries that don't come to the fund. We view ourselves much more as the doctor, that when the patient gets sick, they come and seek advice from a doctor, but there are some people who think that because they got sick because of the doctor, and we need to, frankly, to do a better job of explaining just what our role is.
Okay, that's interesting. The thing is, like, the IMF started off like around 1944, and IMF really didn't start structural adjustment until 1980.
That's simply not true. Structural adjustment loans were going in the 70s, and indeed the advice that that the IMF was giving to countries like the United States and elsewhere in the 50s and 60s and 70s were the equivalent of structural adjustment. It's just the name structural adjustment didn't exist then. The idea that countries should balance their budgets and that businesses should not be subsidized is an idea as old as economics. It is not something new from the name structural adjustment.
Okay, but it was on the IMF World IMF website, and it said that structural adjustment that started in 1980.
A program called structural adjustment lending was established then, but that is not to say that the idea is a new name. It's just a different title. It's simple economics, the facts of life.
One campaign that's been going on for a few years now is the Jubilee campaign that
right.
I'm sure you've heard of dropping the debt of third world countries. A lot of these third world countries went to the IMF, I guess, to ask for economic assistance, and some of those governments were either corrupt or dictatorships, and the people now have to repay debts that their governments did not pay in the past, and now they have new governments, and now they're forced to repay those debts. How does the International Monetary Fund feel about those countries? Should they, if we drop the debt of those countries, would they be able to rebuild their economy? Or what's the IMF's view on
We actually have been very supportive of debt reduction. We have something called the Highly Indebted Poor Country Program, where indeed the debt owed by the very poorest countries is in the process of being reduced by some two-thirds. There certainly are cases of countries where the debt was incurred by regimes that are no longer in power and used for purposes that may not have been for the benefit of the poor. However, I would stress that a minority of that money in any of the countries came from either the World Bank or the IMF. In fact, many of it came from bilateral creditors. And bilateral creditors, by the way, individual governments, that is, by the way, are also in the process of reducing debt. And so, indeed, we have a great deal of sympathy for the debt reduction effort. But debt reduction itself is not a cure. It can ease the burden, but first of all, it will depend on how countries use the resources freed up by not having to pay the debt, if they continue to use it for purposes such as arms races or wasteful expenditures. That's not going to do any good. If industrial countries refuse to open their markets to the goods of the poorest countries, that's going to leave these countries mired in poverty, and indeed, opening up trade barriers for the poorest countries can do far more, it's just a mathematical fact, far more than any amount of debt reduction. And then finally, of course, foreign assistance, which has been cut back over the last couple of decades to the poorest countries, also can be of assistance, although I should note that Canada has a better record in that regard than many of our member countries.
How do you answer the criticism of a lot of groups, like the Jubilee people and a lot of other activist groups that have been very vocal for the past few years, that the IMF policies reflect the controlling interests of the International Monetary Fund, banks, and multinational corporations, and particularly those from the United States and Europe? And they see this as a new form of colonialism. How do you answer that criticism?
Well, I think the reality is that we have a staff with employees from 143 countries. The programs we work are worked with finance ministers from the borrowing countries. We place increased emphasis on countries designing their own programs and then coming to us for assistance. And I think the idea that we are dictating a so-called one-size-fits-all structure that benefits multinational corporations is nonsense. Indeed, multinational corporations are quite suspicious of the IMF in particular as being a regulator, because the reality is the IMF does have substantial authority in the world, and I can guarantee you, having been in the private sector, that we view the IMF as a potential regulator of international activity, not the not an agent acting on the behalf of global capitalism.
We're speaking with Tom Dawson, spokesperson for the International Monetary Fund. He's speaking to us live from Washington, D.C. What exactly will you be discussing? What's on the order of the day at for the meetings in Ottawa that were supposed to be held, I believe, was it in India?
Well, actually, there are two sets of meetings that are being combined. The so-called G20 meeting, which Paul Martin is the basically godfather and mentor of, was to have been held in India on November 20th. The World Bank and IMF were supposed to have their annual meetings this last September, end of September in Washington, and that was canceled because of September 11th. And our meetings that will be taking place on the 17th and 18th are of the International Monetary and Financial Committee, which is an IMF entity, and the Development Committee, which is a joint World Bank IMF entity. We will be meeting, this is a group of 24 members of finance ministers from around the world, central bank governors, and they are our governing board. So they will be having a couple of days of meetings to review the state of the global economy in light of the events of September 11th, the impact on the very poorest countries in particular, and also how the international community can cooperate in the area of money laundering and financial terrorism.
What's the IMF's role with Afghanistan? Has there been any contacts whatsoever with the Afghan government before this?
Afghanistan is a member of the IMF, but of course the current regime in Afghanistan is not recognized by the UN or by almost any other country in the world. The last time there have been serious discussions between the fund and Afghanistan was back in 1994. Of course, if there were a transition government, we would be in a position to come in and provide technical assistance and so on, which is a situation we have done in other cases around the world. I would cite the Balkans. I would cite East Timor as example.
But even back in 1992, and this is more of the World Bank than the IMF, but even the World Bank, the so-called Wappenhaus report.
Willie, I knew Willie, yes.
Yes, and the official report was called the World Bank Structural and Sectoral Adjustment Operations, 1992, World Bank Report by the Operations Evaluation Department. And from this own report, it says that Sub-Saharan Africa, is less than 20% of the operations were substantially effective, and 15% only had negligible impact. The report acknowledges that, quote, income inequality in rural areas appears to have gone up in some countries as landless farm owners bear a greater burden of higher food prices. And in the Ivory Coast, quote, poverty increased by 4.8% during the year 80-85 to hardcore poverty by 7.9% a year. So what has the IMF World Bank done to improve on the failures highlighted by the Wappenhaus report?
We have done a substantial amount. Our the nature of our lending programs in those countries, in sub-Saharan Africa in particular, has changed fundamentally. We go in and loan in those countries only when the government itself develops a program, a so-called poverty reduction strategy paper, that we then go in and support. I would also note that the reality that that many social indicators in a number of the African countries have deteriorated over the decades despite fund and or World Bank assistance does not mean it wouldn't have been worse without our assistance. Indeed, the track record of countries that have received no assistance from the fund and the World Bank is worse than the track record of those that have. So there's a little bit of a spurious relationship in that. On the other hand, the Wappenhaus report, which of course had absolutely nothing to do with the IMF, but I am familiar with it from that period, was the occasion for the institutions, the bank in particular, but also the fund, to draw lessons and try to do things better. And indeed, we believe the record shows at present, we've done studies that are publicly available on our so-called Enhanced Structural Adjustment Facility, a report that we prepared a couple of years ago, showing that the performance in the countries under these programs is better than, in terms of social indicators, than the countries that are not benefiting from World Bank and IMF assistance.
And just to follow up on some of the points that you've raised, you've brought in a lot of statistics in terms of countries being improved, and I'm wondering if the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund keep statistics on how citizens are impacted by programs.
Absolutely, particularly the bank does, since they are a project lender. We do not lend for projects at all. We lend basically for general balance of payments, budget support. But the World Bank does have substantial research, regularly published, available on their website on that.
The World Bank, and so do you have any statistics available on how poor people have been impacted and possibly how many people have died because of World Bank and IMF policy?
We don't believe there is any such relationship at all. Indeed, I direct you to the bank because the bank has done substantial reports on that. The fact that there are people dying in poor countries and the bank is, and or fund are lending to the countries, there's no causal relationship there at all. And indeed, the records are better in the countries that are receiving bank and fund assistance than those that are not.
And I'm just wondering.
It is available, publicly available on the web. The bank regularly addresses this issue.
So we'll check that out. And I'm wondering if you've gone to any good movies lately. Have you seen Life and Debt?
I know about Life and Debt, and that was a piece of work worthy of Joseph Stalin and Goebbels in terms of taking quotations from Michael Manley from the 1970s, juxtaposing it with interviews from the year 2001, going back to the 1980s, and taking commentary from other people, and never once in the documentary indicating that they were juggling the timeline.
Tom Dawson, one last question. What's the best way to fight terrorism? I always ask these questions and at the end of the interview.
Well, I think that the best way is to provide a decent opportunity for people to have a prosperous society, a peaceful society, and that means, from an economics point of view, fundamentally trying to get growth going, international cooperation, and trade, and have people working and communicating with each other.
All right, Tom Dawson, thank you very much for this.
Surely. All right, bye-bye.
This was Tom Dawson, spokesperson for the International Monetary Fund. The International Monetary Fund are headquartered in Washington, D.C. That's where he was speaking to us from. And they will be meeting the IMF, the World Bank, and the G20 in Ottawa in a few weeks' time, November 16th, 17th, and 18th, I believe. And you can always check out the IMF's webpage for more propaganda at www.imf.org. All right, we're going to be speaking now with Michel Chostudovsky, who's on the line with us from Montreal. Michel, are you with us?
Yes.
How do you view the International Monetary Fund? A lot of people say that the International Monetary Fund should be reformed or should be restructured, and what's your view on it?
Well, first of all, I would have loved to participate in this debate with the Director of Public Relations. I've read many of his pieces, which he writes periodically to the media. And, of course, his role is really to give a human face to the IMF. He's the public relations is really part of it. And trying to convey the idea that the IMF is in fact helping countries when, if you look at the logic of these reforms, which are, you know, I would say this is like Mike Harris to the nth degree. It's devastating austerity measures, deregulation of prices, leading to hyperinflation. We have in the last 20 years documented cases of countries which virtually have been destroyed as a result of IMF reforms, and this takes place through a market mechanism.
We were able to ask him if the IMF and World Bank keeps statistics, and of course he said we do. We have an overwhelming amount of statistics, and they're available on the web. And when I asked him if he had any statistics on the number of poor people that have died because of IMF and World Bank policy, he said no one has died.
Well, you know, this is, of course, the thing is that these reforms take place. They don't simply. The IMF doesn't go around shooting people, okay? What they do is that they close down hospitals, they close down schools, they deregulate food prices. And this, in fact, directly creates poverty in a very devastating way. I'll just give you an example because I have the figures in front of me. In August 1990, in Peru, there was an IMF program which was imposed on the government. It was a devaluation plus the liberalization of domestic prices. Now, fuel prices went up more than 30 times overnight. Okay? From gasoline went up from 22 intis to 675 overnight. You can imagine the devastation. Now, talking about the impact on nutrition or children, the price of milk went up from 60 to 290, in other words, nearly a 400% increase. The price of bread went up from 2 to 25, a 12-time increase in the price of bread, 1,200% overnight. Now, to say that doesn't impact on people, it's devastating. It leads to a collapse in the standard of living, which is virtually immediate. I've been compiling this kind of information and data on the impacts of IMF reforms for at least 10 years. And again, if I give the case of Peru, real wages in Peru went down by more than 90%, resulting from a whole series of IMF reforms over a period of years. And you'll find the same pattern in other countries. Perhaps not as abrupt. I mean, in some cases you see prices go up 2 or 3 times rather than 30 times. But in any event, the balance sheet of these reforms is absolutely clear cut. It's documented, and we have to look at issues of essentially prices, wages, and employment. As well as farm prices, to get an idea of how the IMF impacts people's lives.
Do you see a role for the IMF in the future, despite its poor or bad, terrible record, as you described?
Well, you see, the thing is that the IMF is a bureaucracy. It's not. I don't view necessarily the IMF as the power, as actual political or economic power. It is a bureaucracy. It serves the interests of the New World Order. It interfaces with the private banking system, namely Wall Street. It has links with the U.S. Treasury. It has links with NATO, with the World Bank, with the World Trade Organization in Geneva. In other words, it's part of the institutions which govern the New World Order. So the issue is not really to say whether we need to reform the World Bank or whether we have to get rid of it or whether it should be more humane. The issue is how does the IMF and the World Bank, how do these organizations function within the World Order system? And now we're in a state of war. We realize that war and globalization are interconnected processes. And in fact, we also know that these organizations interface. NATO interfaces with IMF. So my answer to that is, let's look at the system in its totality. Let's start to disarm it. And when we say disarm, I mean disarm, I mean military disarmament as well as financial disarmament.
We've been speaking with Michel Chassendowski, professor of economics at the University of Ottawa, about the International Monetary Fund. On a final note, I have to ask you this question. How do we combat terrorism in the world?
How do we combat terrorism? But that's somewhat a different question. I think that to combat terrorism, we have to know what the sources of terrorism. And the evidence points directly to the Bush administration, which is applying a form of state terrorism in different parts of the world. The IMF is a form of economic terrorism. It's how the International Monetary Fund intervenes in the affairs of sovereign countries and imposes certain economic and social policies. That is the basis of this of terrorism in the system that we have today. And then we have to start looking at the relationship, and that's much more complex, I can't get into it, between U.S. foreign policy and international terrorism. We know for a fact that in the Balkans today, the U.S. government is supporting the Kosovo Liberation Army, which is a terrorist organization which has links to Osama bin Laden. Now, the question that we have to ask ourselves, how come the U.S. government is supporting Osama bin Laden in Kosovo and Macedonia, and at the same time it is out is using this as a pretext to wage a war on Afghanistan? And incidentally, now we're talking about more than 3 million refugees. In other words, the impacts of state terrorism defined as U.S. foreign policy are literally devastating.
All right, Michel Chassendowski, thank you very much for being with us this morning.
You're absolutely welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And if you want more information on research being done by Michel Chassendowski, there's a webpage, I believe. What's the webpage, Michel?
The webpage is the webpage of the Center for Research on Globalization, which is at globalresearch.ca. I repeat, globalresearch.ca. In one word, .ca.
And you've also written a book entitled The Globalization of Poverty, which should be available in most bookstores in French and English.
Thanks to CKUT in Montreal for that material.
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse.
Perhaps the most scathing indictment of the activities of the IMF, the World Bank, and the World Trade Organization comes from a former chief economist of the World Bank, Joseph Stiglitz. Stiglitz spoke out against the organization's policies and was fired as a result in 1999. Greg Pallast of the London Observer spoke extensively with Stiglitz following his dismissal. Pallast published the results of his investigation in a series of articles in the London Observer. The following article by Pallast was published on October 10th.